So, the YB has done work at the Promenade, right? And there's like these Christian fundamentalists that are there or whatever. And, you know, they always have this rap about the New Testament is different than the Old Testament, you know, and we go after this shit. Like, you know what I'm saying? We have a lot of struggle with these guys, and they're just like, you know, but we don't believe in that Bible. We believe in this Bible. You know what I'm saying? So I was just wondering, like, what would you say to them if you were there and stuff, you know?
Well, I think it's very important. With a lot of people, including a lot of good people, get caught up in this for various reasons. I mean, I was watching one of these, you know, religious programs on TV last night, and, you know, they had this whole guy, you know, was talking to this audience denouncing homosexuality and everything, and it was an audience of really, you know, basic people. Many of them were black, Latinos, and so on. You know, so a lot of good people get caught up in this. It's an important, I believe, it's important to win them away from it, but I don't think you can win them away from it if you don't challenge their basic assumptions. And I think you have to get right down to look. Let's understand this way. There is a very fundamental contradiction in these people's thinking between their insistence that the Bible is literally the Word of God and every word in it is true. And on the other hand, the fact that they don't want to uphold a lot of things that are actually in the Bible when you confront them with it. So I think that has to be driven. It really has to be driven at people kind of relentlessly. I don't mean you have to treat them like enemies, because there are some good people caught up in this, but I mean they have to sort of relentlessly go after this contradiction that, look, as I was saying earlier, one way or the other, you know, do you believe in the Bible, the whole Bible, you know, as God's word, or don't you? And if you do, then defend this and this and this and this. And if you don't, then no cheating. Because if you are going to say that you don't want to uphold this and this and this, then you can't say that this is the divinely inspired word of God and every point has to be upheld. That's what I mean by no cheating. It's one way or the other. You can't at one and the same time say this is the divinely inspired word of God. You know, when you hear these preachers get up and God says, and they're talking about a verse in the Bible. Well, if you believe that God says everything that's in the Bible, then you have to uphold everything. Who are you to say what of God's word should be thrown in the garbage can? Because you don't like it. So it's one way or the other. You know, either you have to say you believe all this because this is God's word, then you have to uphold things that a lot of them don't want to uphold. Or you have to admit that every word is not divinely inspired by God. And if you admit that every word is not divinely inspired by God, then you are admitting that you are the one who is the authority here, not God. Because then you are admitting that you are just choosing what out of the Bible you want to uphold. And so therefore there cannot be any divine authority behind it because you're throwing out parts you don't like. So I think you can't really go after this unless you hit at the foundation and really drive home this contradiction. You can't have it both ways. You know, yes, there are some differences between the New Testament and the Old Testament, but the New Testament is bad enough. I mean, in the New Testament, slavery is upheld, the inferior and oppressed condition of women is upheld. The idea that only if you believe in Christianity can you have the right kind of life is upheld. Inequalities in society are upheld. All these things are in the New Testament. True, they're not as grotesque as they are in the Old Testament. But they're all, those things are upheld. You know, Paul writes and tells a slave to go back to his master that he's run away from and to be obedient to his master. You know, and he tells women that they should be silent in public because women are punished because of what Eve did and they have to be subordinate to a man. All this stuff is right in the New Testament. So, but you know, look, they can't get away with this. They, you know, the first thing I would say to them is they want to say the New Testament is different than the Old. I'd say, so then you don't believe in the Old Testament, right? So we can get rid of that part of it. Then we can work on the other part, right? So, you know, because if they're going to say that, then the logical conclusion, okay, then let's throw out the Old Testament. Let's just talk about the New. We got to, hey, look, that's already a big victory. Here's the Old Testament. So let's get them to agree then to throw out that part, and then let's go to work on the New Testament. But, you know, I really believe you have to, you have to hit at the contradiction there and really keep driving at it. And show them, look, and not just leave it there, but this is a way of understanding that this was written by people several thousand years ago who live in these kind of societies where this kind of thing was accepted as the norm, especially among those who were ruling in this society, who are the main people who write history and who write scriptures and things like that. This is the way they thought the world should be, and they projected a God that was in conformity with the society that they wanted to upheld and believed in. And that's what you really have to bring home to people. This is, you know, and there are real reasons why different scriptures get adopted at different times. For example, Islam was partly, one of the questions you could ask, why do people in Saudi Arabia believe in and practice Islam? Well, to a significant degree, it's a result of the outcome of military battles that were fought by Muhammad and his followers against the authorities, you know, who were upholding a different religion in Mecca. And actually, Muhammad was driven out of Mecca and had to take refuge in Medina because the old tribal religions and the tribal, you know, patriarchs and rulers who upheld these different religions ganged up on him and drove him out. And then he was able to come back and defeat them. So it's partly for military reasons that people in Saudi Arabia practice Islam, but it's also there were other material factors going along with it, namely that, you know, this Mecca was becoming a big trading center. And they, you know, that a lot of people were passing through. One of the reasons why Islam has a lot of influence from the Judeo tradition is there were a lot of Jews who had spread out over different parts of the world, and many of them were living, or a number of them were living in that area of Mecca. So a lot of the beginning of the Quran, particularly where it talks about the creation and all that, is modeled after the Jewish scriptures. And the, Islam looks to Abraham as a big patriarch also. So, you know, there are material reasons why people adopted these different religions. And one of the things favoring Muhammad, for example, was that there was these trading classes, merchant classes that were emerging because of the trade that was going through Mecca. And they had a need for a religion that would unite things beyond the different tribal divisions in order to be more effectively able to carry out the trade and so on. So this was a factor that ultimately was on Muhammad's side, even though he had to fight battles, and he could have lost them. And if he'd lost them, some other religion, maybe like Islam, would have emerged, but it wouldn't have been exactly the same religion if Muhammad had been defeated in military battle with the authorities in Mecca and had been killed. The reason I'm going into all this is this: we have to bring people out in a, what we call historical materialist understanding of how these things arose and what they actually reflect of the world and society out of which they arose, and that they're not some divinely inspired thing. But the reason I say first go after this contradiction is because that's a way of getting to that. That's a way of beginning to make people confront the contradictions in what they believe and then taking it deeper to show them where this really came from. And then you pose to people, okay, look, is this the best that humanity can do, what's in these scriptures? And the things that are reflected and upheld there and the things that are commanded and celebrated there, is that the best that humanity can do at this stage? Can't we do a lot better than that? And then you bring out what we do need. So I think it's going to be an ongoing struggle. I mean, I'm talking about different things you can do, but this is not going to be, you know, if somebody's going to be won and lost in a day, you know. This is an ongoing struggle. But I do think you have to take the offensive. And you have to not let them slide or cheat. You know, you got to pinpoint the contradiction and say, look, one way or the other here. And then I think you can proceed from there.
Hello. Thank you for coming here and giving us your speech. One of the questions I want to ask you, what could we do to stop, or what's a good way to fight religion in school and to turn on kids to revolution and fight against everything that the school preaches to us? Yeah.
Well, there is a whole battle going on about the question of whether religion is going to be reintroduced in the schools in a much bigger way. When I was growing up, you know, it was just like straight up Christianity all over the schools. You know, we didn't have any quote unquote winter holidays or anything. We had Christmas, baby. You know what I mean? It's like, and there wasn't no multiculturalism or diversity about it. We just had, and that's what these people want. Let's get right back to the, all these other are inferior and false religions. So there's a big battle, you know, shaping up about trying to re-inject, you know, so far, you know, like the, you know, Bush has said, for example, about abortion, well, right now we haven't created the culture, the public opinion to completely outlaw it. But that's clearly the direction in which they want to move things. And the same thing is true of religion. Right now, they have not created the conditions and don't feel a complete necessity to force religion back into schools more the way it was before the 60s. But there is a definite struggle going on. And one of the big fronts of this struggle, by the way, is this whole thing over evolution. And I think that this is a very important battle to take up. I mean, this really reminds me of the whole thing with the church and Galileo. You know, several hundred years ago, you know, the view of the church was that, you know, straight out of the Bible, that the earth was the center of everything. All the heavens, as they were called, were created for the benefit of man on earth. Man was God's highest creation. And then, of course, they were within man. Within the society of man, there were hierarchical relations with the church authorities and the, you know, the political authorities on the top. And the big landowners were on the top and all the way down to the bottom with the poor people and the peasants and so on. And this was a very highly ordered view of a universe where everything had its place, as I was referring to. When Copernicus came along about 400 or 500 years ago and started recognizing that the earth was not the center of everything, that in fact it revolved around a sun, and that there was much, much more out there besides just the sun, for that matter. And when Galileo, you know, came along and supplied certain proofs of this, this challenged the whole order of society that the church was a key part of upholding. And they actually forced Galileo to recant, to take back his proofs, after threatening to torture him if he didn't. And Galileo was still a religious man, but he, you know, made the scientific discovery. This was a period of a lot of scientific discoveries and astronomy and other things. And the church persecuted him mercilessly because, not because what he was showing wasn't true, but because it challenged the whole set of relationships in society that the church was dominating, was on top of, and was seeking to maintain. And in a lot of ways, this whole thing around evolution is the modern day form or equivalent of that kind of a battle. Because the notion or the understanding that human beings are just one, you know, line of a long evolutionary development, and that we're on the one hand linked with all these previous ancestor species going back to simple bacteriological forms billions of years ago, but you know, and there are other branches that have developed and have died off, and that there's no direction or purpose that's being guided by some supreme being to the development of life, but it's just what happens through the interplay of changes in the structure of the genes and the outside environment. That challenges, once again, in the same way that Galileo and Copernicus discoveries did, it challenges the idea that there's, you know, that there's an order in which things are supposed to be as they were created by God. And it challenges the whole notion that, you know, things can't be fundamentally changed. And people who are, you know, one to oppose evolution are doing it on the basis of society's going to hell. You know, they don't care whether evolution is true or not. They want to try to argue that it's not, but really what they're about is everything that used to make life orderly and acceptable is being shaken up by the idea that there's no God ruling over all this and that human beings are just a process of this evolution. Well, for there's actually nothing to be afraid of in this. In other words, so what if we just evolved through these processes? Here we are, and we're going to make out of our society what we can make out of it. You know, and the mysteries of the universe and the quest to understand more is no less important just because it wasn't created by some God. There's still plenty to learn and plenty to be excited about when you discover new vistas of things that were never known to people. There's really exciting, like there's a thing going on in physics now which I don't know too much about, but it's this whole thing about black holes, which is this very dense matter that sucks in everything around it out in space. And this leading theoretical physicist, Stephen Hawking, had for a long time argued that black holes suck everything out in and nothing can get out. And so no information can be learned once you have this black hole. And other scientists were arguing against this and saying that if we could learn about what happens in these black holes, it would tell us a lot about the origins of the universe as it now exists, and a lot of other things could be learned. And they have a big debate, and Stephen Hawking just came out and admitted he was wrong, which is, a good thing. That's what a scientist should do if the evidence indicates that what you previously believed was wrong. But this is very exciting. There's no lack of excitement there. And that happens all the time in trying to understand reality the way it really is. There's plenty of excitement. And, these people feel like, the world used to be ordered the way it should be. A man, ran his home, and black people knew their place. And women were subordinate to men, and a man could be a man, goddammit. You didn't have to worry about some sexual harassment suit if you went and put your hand up the secretary's dress and all this kind of shit, And now the whole world's going to hell because of evolution. Now, sometimes they don't say it that crudely, but that's really what's behind this, We can't control our kids anymore. And look, there is a lot of bullshit out there, let's be honest, You put on MTV or BET and watch these rap videos. I'm sorry, man. It's just like a lot of it is just very mildly and not so mildly softcore pornography and degradation of women. I'm sorry, because that's what the powers that be promoted. They didn't promote Fight the Power. They didn't promote some of the earlier stuff, like the message from Grandmaster Flash and Melly Mel and stuff. They promoted this stuff because that's what reinforces what they want out there. And if you want to make money, this is what you rap about. And the people that do get promoted and the people that talk about something more serious and something to do with making a better world don't get promoted. And some stuff still busts through, but there's a struggle going on there too. So a lot of people also are reacting to this. There's a lot of garbage that gets churned out by this society and the relations that it has. And people also, not for terrible reasons, don't like that either. And they all associate with everything's going to hell ever since we took God out of the classroom, which was a neat trick since there never was a God. But somehow, they took God out of the classroom. And if there really were a God, could anybody really take God out of the classroom? The idea that you could practice religion in the classroom has been the concessions have been made to the idea there shouldn't be a religious state, And these people want to reverse that. But there's a mixed bag of things going on that people feel the society's going to hell. And this is a society that's full of a lot more uncertainty than it used to be. Used to be like, you say you got a job in a steel mill. Well, your kid could get it, or at least your male child could get a job in a steel mill and so on and so forth. And if you were in a managerial position, you could make a lot of money and you could have a lot of job security. And now you can make $1 million in a few years and then be out on your ass because your job got outsourced to India, where they can pay some, computer tech guy a lot less than you. So there's a lot of instability and uncertainty and volatility and constant changingness that makes people feel they can't get a grip on things. And so these right wing, basically these Christian fascists come along and say it's all because we got rid of God as the center of everything. And now they're teaching us about evolution and, man is just another thing like an ape and all that kind of stuff, which is, they don't even really try to engage an actual scientific understanding of evolution. They just distort it. But I think this is one of the key battlefronts to, first of all, fight through that evolution, look, is a well-established scientific fact, at least as much as Galileo's proof that the Earth is not the center of the universe, but rather revolves as one planet around the sun. And there's nothing to fear from that. And what we really have to get to is why is this world the way it is, and how can we change it so it's a world that people can actually live in and come alive in and feel that they want to be in that world. So I think this is going to be a lot of the struggle. We have to fight over the actual, have to fight to uphold the truth. Evolution is a truth. I really again urge people to read this series within our paper. We're hoping to find some way to publish it as a whole thing so people can read the entire thing. But in the meantime, you can get it off the web. And you know, and it does actually work to break this down and to go into all different dimensions of it, so that you can understand why the, you know, what the scientific basis for this understanding is, and how this is one of the most well-established facts in all of science. See, one of the things these reactionaries do is they take the word theory, which has a different meaning in science than it does in a lot of popular language. In science, theory doesn't mean something that may or may not be true necessarily. It means an attempt at an explanation of a phenomenon. Well, this is a theory that's not only attempts to explain a phenomenon, namely how life evolved, including human beings, but has very thoroughly and from many different angles demonstrated the fact of evolution and shown many different proofs of evolution for many different fields of science and biology. So when the word theory is used, it just means an explanation in this case. But these anti-science people say, well, it's just a theory, you know, just like creation's a theory. No, it's a scientifically established fact. So that has to be battled out, because attempting to keep people from understanding the truth and understanding the world the way it is can only serve keeping people oppressed and exploited. People cannot fully break the chains of oppression and exploitation if they can't know the way the world really is. And instead, if they're told lies and led to believe lies and distortions of how the world really is. So I think this is one major battle that has to be waged. I mean, it has gotten so bad that in a lot of school systems, by state policy, they do not even use the word evolution. They'll talk about things like development over time. Well, what is that doing to the youth? You know, insofar as they learn or get introduced to any of this at all, they're being denied this is one of the most fundamental facts about all reality, is the truth of evolution. And these people are making tremendous headway because they are organized and determined to wage this battle to drive this out of the schools and keep people from understanding reality the way it is. They want people chained to this reactionary view of human life and existence and of the role of humanity and the role of different groups and classes in society in this highly ordered, top-down kind of society. So this is one key battlefront. I think it has to be waged against these people. And also the whole battle over, you know, prayer in the schools. I mean, some of this shit gets really ridiculous, you know. I mean, I am sick to death of these athletes get up and you know, thanking God for their victories. Even if I believe there were a God, I don't think God would give a fuck who wins the 100. You know, I saw this program Bryant Gumbel. She has a show on HBO about sports. And it was about religious fundamentalism in sports. And he was interviewing one guy who's sort of not an atheist, but kind of an agnostic. And he's always arguing with these fundamentalists on the football team. And he's telling a story about how one game they were behind by 2 points, for those of you who know football, and it came down to they were trying to kick a field goal at the end of the game to win the game. Or rather, excuse me, the other team was trying to kick a field goal to win the game. His team was ahead by 2 points. So it was a short field goal, and they should have made it, but the guy kicked it and went off to the side and hit the crossbar and bounced out no good. And one of these religious fundamentalists on his team turned to him and said, "Now you can't tell me that God didn't have anything to do with that." And this guy said, "Yeah, that's right. Sure, God doesn't care about all the people that are starving in Africa, but he really cares about this field goal." You know? So, you know, even on this level, this is ridiculous, you know. And I think there is a struggle has to be waged over this kind of thing, you know, that people are you know, trying to impose this kind of a fundamentalist viewpoint everywhere in society. And they actually want a society where, you know, you have to live by, quote unquote, the word of God as dictated by religious authorities who are very human and who have a definite agenda. And, you know, this is a struggle going on in this society. There's, you know, it's part of the larger struggle to get rid of this whole system. It's not that struggle in and of itself or the whole of it, but it is an important part of the struggle. If people are denied the truth, and if they're denied a method for approaching reality and learning about reality, they can never get free of their enslavement in one form or another. And this is a battle that has to be fought out. You know, I think At the same time, is you have to try to win people away from this. Because as I said, there are a lot of people who are into this for a lot of different reasons. You know, there are a lot of youth, for example, that go out and they try drugs and they live a lifestyle where they're trying everything out. And then they get to the point where they don't, you know, it isn't satisfying and they feel like there's no purpose or center to their lives. And they're just risking their lives for nothing, really. You know, taking ecstasy or whatever, you know, or even more serious drugs. And so a lot of them try to get themselves centered by turning to something that'll sort of give them, that's what I was trying to say about consolidating all your afflictions and addictions. They try to turn towards something that'll be powerful enough and absolute enough that'll keep them out of all this stuff they've been getting into. Well, I think we have to understand this. And we have to not treat all these people as enemies, but we do have to struggle about what's the truth of the world. And what is the way out of all this? Why do we have a society like this? You know, if Bill Cosby wanted to do something good, why doesn't he go to the government and say, set up a program to train all these youth who have no jobs to be skilled with computers and then give them all a job? But I'll tell you why the government will never do that, because they can't give everybody a job, even the people that are already trained in computer skills. And the last thing they want is to train a whole bunch of youth to have expectations of a better life and then frustrate those expectations. This is exactly what happened in the 60s. People came through the whole period of segregation, for example, in the South, seeing that start to be challenged and broken up, and people felt that new vistas were opening up to them. That restraints that had been on them and limitations that had been on what was possible for them were being broken down, and that they could really, you know, finally have a chance to flourish in society. And then they ran into this same oppression and discrimination and segregation, sometimes in slightly different forms, and this became very explosive. That's why you got the tremendous, or that's a big part of why you got the tremendous upheavals of the 60s and cities burning all across the country. And the last thing that the powers that be want is to raise expectations that they then can only dash once again. And this is an indictment of a system. I mean, what kind of a system is it where you have millions of youth who have more prospect of going to prison than they have of getting a decent education? Millions of youth, more than 2 million people in prison. A huge percentage of Black and Latino youth caught up in the legal system even when they're not in prison. What kind of world is that? What kind of system is that? That's absolutely unnecessary. Think of all the human potential that's being destroyed and ground up as a result of that. Think of all the potential doctors and scientists and artists, some of whom even break through and create new art. But think of all how many more people could be doing all these things instead of hanging around on the corner and then trying to find some way to do something that'll get them somewhere and they end up in jail or dead. And killing each other in form. That's what it looks like. They're killing each other. But I say they're not killing each other. The system is killing them and getting them to do it to each other by putting them in that situation and then incurring that. What kind of system is that? Why is that necessary? It's completely unnecessary. But people will never break out of this as long as they're chained with the idea that this is why I'm so angry at Bill Cosby. I mean, you know, I once went to a cultural program that Bobby Seale was part of back in the late 60s. I don't know if you all know this, but he was actually a comedian for a while. And he was very funny. And he used to do perfect impersonations of like Kennedy and all these other people. I cracked up. But he told this joke back then about Bill Cosby. You know, that Bill Cosby got this on this TV program. He's one of the first Black actors to get a major role on TV. But the program, part he played in his program called I Spy, he played a CIA agent. So Bobby Seale told this joke about how, you know, all the Indians got mad at the white man, and they surrounded the white man and said, "Look what you've been doing to us all these years." And the white man said, "So what? Tonto's with us." You know, Tonto, the sidekick of the Lone Ranger, says, "So what? Tonto is with us." And then all the people in Africa and around the third world got mad at America, and they said, "Look what you're doing to us." And they said, so what? Bill Cosby is with us. But, you know, I'm not even writing him off completely at this point. But somebody's got to sharply point out, if you want to do some good, get with the people in fighting against their oppression. Quit condemning them and making them be responsible for the fact that they're oppressed. Sure, people do things they shouldn't do. And we need to struggle with people over that. But let's give them a way out that's a real way out, not a way that reinforces the idea that there's something wrong with them that makes them be in the position they're in. And if they would just start acting right, then they could get out of this mess. Because that's not true. A lot of people try that road and they get pulled back in anyway. Because there is no avenue for them in this system. And that's one of the reasons why this system has to go. And the struggle against religious fundamentalism has to be put in that context. Because this hold of religion on people keeps them from breaking free of the mental constraints, the mental fetters, the mental chains that keep them from really understanding the world the way it is. And as part of that, a key part of that, understanding why they're in the situation they're in. And even more importantly, that why the world doesn't have to be this way anymore and why they no longer have to be in that situation and how through a revolutionary struggle they can change all that. So we have to take up the struggle against this reactionary religious fundamentalism in that context and with that kind of understanding.
Hello, Mr. Vakian. I was wondering, what do you think about people that's part of religious sects, you know, like, you know, people that happen to be part of different Muslim sects and all that, and they want to see change, and they don't see change of the other, I mean, like, through other leaders. And only change they only see is through the RCP and people that wants to do something, you know, and all that and stuff. But they happen to be part of a Muslim sect or a different religious sect or something like that. And it's like, you know, what would you say about people that's part of a religious sect that don't want to stop practicing their religion, but still they want to carry forth on revolution?
Well, thank you. I think that's a very important question. I'm glad you raised it. I think this is what I was trying to say earlier about where we need to apply a principle of unity, struggle, unity. In other words, we need to unite with people who want to fight against oppression. At the same time, we need to carry on a struggle about how to understand this oppression and, you know, in its full depth and where it comes from and what's the solution to it. These are things that people who are religious and people who are not, or atheists and communists, don't agree on. But we do agree on a lot of the things that are wrong and that they should be changed. And we can unite around a lot of particular things like fights against police brutality and discrimination and the wars that the government wages and things like that, even while we're disagreeing and struggling over these other things. And that's what we mean by a process of unity, struggle, unity. We find if people stand, and wherever people stand with the fight against oppression, we should unite with them there. Wherever we disagree with them about where that fight needs to go and what's the final and all, you know, what's the complete solution to it, or what's the fundamental solution to it? We should struggle over these things. And that struggle should be a struggle among people who, in an overall sense, are on the same side. Doesn't mean it won't be sharp sometimes, but we shouldn't be treating each other as enemies if we're on the same side in the larger sense, or in the main. If we have more areas of agreement than disagreement, then we should act accordingly. Even while we should have good struggle. I mean, that's life, is struggle. You know, people struggle all the time with each other about things they don't agree over. And there's nothing wrong with that if we keep in mind what the goal is, which is to get rid of and uproot all this oppression. And then we can have this struggle about, you know, we should try to get to the truth. And as long as we don't agree about what the truth is, we should keep on struggling about it. But we should also unite wherever we can unite in the fight against oppression. And this will be a long-term process. You cannot force people to give up things that they believe. And you should not try to force them to do it. You can try to persuade them. You can argue vigorously with them. But you cannot force people. And if you try to force people, you'll do great harm. And if you try to jack them up, or if you're running a society and you try to put a gun to their head and say, give up that belief, you'll do great harm. You won't convince them, and you'll do great harm. So as long as these differences exist, we have to keep struggling over them while we seek to find the most ways we can to unite in this struggle. And, you know, the truth, it doesn't win out by itself. If it did, we'd be rid of this system now because it's no good, and that's the truth. But there are powerful forces that benefit from it who want to keep it going. So it takes a struggle for the truth to win out. You have to change society, and then you have to struggle over people's ideas in the process of changing society. And then people will, you know, if they become convinced that something is different than the way they thought it is, then they can, you know, give it up and change and believe something else. But, you know, if you struggle with them in a good way, then you can move things toward that. But if you struggle with them in a way that's not respectful of them when they should be, in other words, I don't respect the people that run the society, you know, so I'm not gonna bother to try to have an approach of seeking the positive side of them because they don't have one. But with people who are oppressed and trying to fight against oppression, you have to try to find and unite with the positive side even while you struggle with what you think is negative, and vice versa. I mean, people who are religious think we've got it all wrong, you know, and that we're gonna mess up because we don't understand that, you know, God's role in all this, or Allah, the role of Allah, or whatever. So that's a difference we have. So we have to struggle over that, but we should be able to find large areas of unity, and wherever we can, we should unite there without burying our differences, because that doesn't do any good either. If you just cover over your differences and you don't have struggle over them, then your unity is not going to really develop either. So we have to have, that's what I mean by this process of unity, struggle, unity. And I think it's very important that we reach out broadly to do this and do it in a good way. Where we have more in common than we have opposed to each other, we should unite. Where we disagree, we should struggle, and we should keep that process going.
It says, I need a spiritual force because it gives me hope to get something favorable and to make me feel good. I haven't broken away with religion because I haven't analyzed why I liked it and why I need it. And after listening to your argument, I'm closer to believing and not believing in God. So.
Mi pregunta es, ¿qué me falta para analizar este sentimiento? ¿Cómo lo debo de razonar para quebrar lo que me conviene, en lo que me conviene creer, para sentirme también?
Make me feel good.
Thank you. Gracias. The question is sort of like, what do I need to help me be able to...
What do I need to help me be able to analyze what I should feel, you know, what I should feel and not feel so I can feel good?
Well, I think this is a big problem, is that we live in a society that makes most people not feel good most of the time. And in order really and fundamentally to have a society where people can feel good, we need to change the whole society. You know, that's the fundamental answer, because the way this thing works, it's always, you know, causing things to happen which make people not feel good. You know, to feel misery in various forms, physical misery, you know, like psychological misery and emotional misery. And that's what's going to keep happening from this system. And one of the things I think we have to do while we're building the struggle to overthrow this system is we have to develop, you know, a movement that speaks to the need that people have to feel that they're part of something that's worthwhile. Because this is one of the whole things about living in a society. You are robbed, most people, the great majority, are robbed of the ability to feel that they're part of something that's worthwhile. And, you know, you scramble to survive and you work and you try to do for your kids or whatever, and then the society is bringing down all kinds of things which makes life miserable for your kids and draws them into all kinds of things that's not good for them. And then you do feel a need for something that can give you some kind of feeling of relief from this and not feel like you're always being beaten down and just, you know, life is just not, you know, like I was listening to this, there was this musical that got killed that Paul Simon did called, the Cape Man. And it was a story about this Puerto Rican youth who who got in this fight, gang war with some kids, Irish kids, and killed one of them and went to jail and then, you know, taught himself to read in jail, became a poet and a writer. And it was the kind of thing that Giuliani, who was the mayor of New York at the time, did not want to see on Broadway. And they got the New York Times critic killed it. But it has, you know, a lot of good songs in it. And one of them is a song that's sung by the mother, you know, the character playing the mother of this character, the Cape Man. And one of the lines of this, you know, life is an ocean of endless tears. And this is the way a lot of people feel living in this society. It's just an ocean of endless tears. And this New York critic said, oh, this is a corny line. You know, this doesn't really speak to... Yeah, well, okay. You know, that just shows that this person didn't have any understanding of what reality that most people go through. You know, for many, many, many people in this society, life is an ocean of endless tears. But the point is that religion does not provide a way out of this or an answer to that. That's why they made the analogy, or taking from Marx's analogy, about a narcotic. It temporarily may supply that, but the society is working to create more and more misery. And you can never get satisfied in that way or get complete relief. So we need to, first of all and most fundamentally, we need a revolution to get rid of the society. There's a much better world that we could have. You look around, there is the potential for everybody in the world to be well-fed, well-clothed, have decent health care, for children not to be dying of diseases that are completely curable. Right now, every day, even as we're speaking, 40,000 children die every day in the third world. 40,000 children die every day from starvation, malnutrition, and diseases that are completely curable. And the infant mortality rate in some of the ghettos of the U.S. is higher than it is in place some poor countries in Latin America. This is completely unnecessary. And people, I mean, there's plenty of technology. That's not the problem. The problem is that it's twisted and distorted under a system that can only utilize things if they can make profit for a handful. And so things that people need that are not profitable don't get done. This is the nature of the capitalist system we live under, and it's absolutely unnecessary. Very quickly, these conditions could be completely changed, and so we need a revolution to achieve this. And while we're building this revolution, we need to give people a sense of being part of something bigger than themselves, something worthwhile, something that makes them feel that it's worthwhile getting up in the morning and facing the world and going out to change it. Even with all the shit that comes down on people. We need to make that part of our movement. We need to, if you want to put it that way, develop even a sense of community within our movement. Even among people who have differences, we need to be reinforcing each other and having a whole orientation and a spirit about our movement that people are helping each other out even as we're struggling for the bigger objective of changing the whole society. There needs to be that kind of spirit about what we're doing. But the fact is, until we get to the other side of this and throw off this system and bring a different society into being, we are going to be dragged down by all the misery and all the horror that this society brings people through. And the only thing worthwhile, as far as I'm concerned, is giving your life to getting rid of this system and bringing a world into being that's right there to be had. I don't mean to say it's easy. I don't mean to say that all these problems are not going to be complicated. And that it won't have to be a lot of struggle to deal with them. But the means are at hand to be able to make life a completely different thing than it is. The world could actually be something that, let's face it, most people don't want to live in the world the way it is now. And they certainly can't come alive in it. And the basis is there to create a world in which that is no longer true. And even our movement, while we can't really accomplish this till we get rid of this system and begin bringing a new world into being, even our movement as we're struggling for that has to bring alive and bring into being elements of that that give people the feeling that they want, as I said, they want to get up in the day and go out in the world, even with all the horrors that are out there, because there's something better that we're striving and struggling and working toward together with growing numbers of people. And I think there's that. And then there's a question of, as I said, approaching the world scientifically. And by that, I don't mean, you know, a lot of times science is misrepresented. And it's presented as kind of thing that nobody but a few, you know, strange people can understand. But, you know, but science in general and the science of communism is not really that. It's just a method for understanding the world the way it is and struggling to learn about more about the world with all the complex things that go into that. It's just a means for understanding the world and then changing it on that basis. And when you actually make a breakthrough and start approaching the world that way, you do actually feel better, even amidst all the misery and oppression that's still there. Because you've thrown off the blinders and you start to actually see the way the world is, but also the way it could be. And this is what we really need. We need to actually rip away the veil, penetrate to what the real reality underneath that is, and then see the ways to change it and begin doing that. And that's the way that I think when you put those things together, that's when you really feel like life is worth living. Doesn't mean that there isn't a lot of shit that comes up in life because we're still living in a system, and until we get rid of it, that's going to be the way it is. But it does mean that life becomes worth living, that you feel that you're part of something that's worth your life being about.
Okay, it's a pleasure to be here with everybody. I love this PCR. I love everything. So we know already we are suffering of oppression for years, centuries. So my question is, how important is the time to begin a revolution?
For years.
Well, one thing, you know, on the one hand, I think it was Mao that said, you know, communists are not fortune tellers. So I can't say exactly when, you know, revolution is going to come. But one thing I will say is what we need to be doing is not waiting. You know, our party has a slogan that we should hasten, even while we're awaiting the development of a situation where we can go all out to make revolution. We should not just be just waiting. We need to be working very actively. You know, I wish that we could have filled up this entire room with people here, but the people who are here are extremely important. Because we can in turn be, if you want to use that term, links, connections, and levers to get a lot of more people drawn into this revolution, into the struggle to change the world. And that's what we need to do, and we need to do it very urgently. For two reasons. Because one, for a long time now, as you're pointing to, this life under this system has been intolerable. It's way past time we needed a revolution. So we need to be actively working toward it. We need to be bringing many more people at least into the struggle over what is the answer to all this and how do we move forward, even while we're reuniting to fight against particular outrages, injustices, and particular, you know, forms of oppression that just can't be tolerated. So we need to be not just waiting, we need to be actively working for revolution all the time and bringing many more people into it and reaching out to them and getting them wrestling with the question of what is this revolution about and is it really possible and should we really do it and what would it really lead to? So every day we need to be bringing more people into it. That's one thing. We need to be working very urgently. And the more we do that, the more it's going to have an impact on larger numbers of people. A lot of shit holds sway now among a lot of the places where people live and work, then we need to change. When the young kids come up, look, I understand why people get into gangs and this other kind of stuff. But when the young kids come up, they need to have something else that they're looking to. They need to have revolution that they're looking to. They need to grow up in a time they're 4 and 5 and start saying they want to be in the revolution. And we got to start creating that now. And the young teenagers, we need to win them to revolution. I don't blame the masses of people, and I don't blame the people who are stuck in horrific conditions for a lot of the stuff they get into. That's why I'm angry at this shit that people like Bill Cosby are saying. But they need something else. They need a different role. They need a different model. They need different people to look up to and to follow. Because they need a way out of this. We don't need to keep this going generation after generation after generation, where you grow up and you start from the time you're a young kid heading down a road that's going to have you dead by the time you're 18 or 21. You know, I try to learn from everything that I can learn from. I read this stupid book by this guy named, it's just like a little pulp paperback book by this guy, Stephen Cannell, who used to write for the Rockford Files and whatever that show was that Robert Blake was in, Beretta, whatever it was. And it's a stupid story. But it has a really heavy part in it where at one point, one of the characters, or several characters who are in this, like, you know, Mexican gang, things like La M A or something like that. And there's a scene where they all go to a place and there's all these coffins there. And they all pick out their coffins. And then they go to a cemetery and pick out their burial plots. These are like teenage kids. And they're planning out what coffin they want to be buried in and what cemetery plot they want to be buried in. This is a stupid book, but it's talking about some reality. This is what the system has in store for kids. I mean, their life is over before they even get born. So we need to very urgently be working for revolution. They need to come into this world and see a revolution there that they can become part of. And we need to take it forward and make it happen. A lot of things have to come together, in a powerful country like this in order to make that happen. You know, there has to be crisis. They have to get, they have to get in more trouble even than they are in a place like Iraq now. But you can imagine that if we're working on this situation very urgently and bringing forward whole legions of youth that are looking to revolution is what they want their life to be about, then that's going to begin to change things and have a broader impact in a society. And if that comes together, where, you know, all of a sudden you have like the massive outpouring that you had in opposition to the Iraq war before it started. And you have people rebelling like they did in L.A. after the Rodney King thing. But in one city after another. And you have the government fighting and the ruling forces of society fighting among themselves because they got into an even worse mess than they got into in Iraq right now. And you have people in the army start questioning what the hell are they, why are they being forced to be in this army and fight these wars one after the other, and they realize they've been lied to about what they were fighting for. And that has a lot to do with what kind of work we do too. If you imagine all that and then there's some spark that sets it off, then the idea of a revolution doesn't seem so impossible. So we can't predict exactly when all these things might come together, but we have to be actively and urgently pushing things to the furthest possible limit we can at every point, winning more and more people and setting up a model so that when people start thinking about what they want to do with their lives, they don't go picking out a coffin as the highest expression of what they can think their life would be about. But they want to go into the revolution. They want to be pushing with others to try to bring more people forward so that if this ruling class stumbles, and there's a whole situation in society where there's here and then there and then here and there, people are rebelling at things that have become intolerable to them, then we have a chance to go for it. And the other thing I want to say is that what you think is tolerable depends on whether or not you think there's anything that can be done about it. As long as you believe, this is another reason why religion has a hold on people, as long as you believe that this is the only way the world could be, that God ordained it to be this way, or that's just fate, or it's your fault, and all this other stuff, then you will tolerate a lot of things that are really intolerable, that are really horrible, that really, you hate, right into your gut, but you accept it because you don't see any other way the world could be. So we have a tremendous role to play in enabling people to see that the world does not have to be this way. That this is not the future for the youth that they should have or have to have. That this is not what people throughout the world need to be groaning under. That there's a way out of all this, not an easy way. And if anybody would tell you it's easy, they're lying, and don't listen to them. Or at least listen to them and then tell them they're wrong. It's going to be hard. It's going to be a lot of struggle. It's going to be very difficult and complicated to figure all this out. And to wage a struggle. And yes, people will have to sacrifice. And yes, some people will have to die. But not for nothing. And not just to keep the same shit going. Over and over again. So there's no other future for the youth but the same thing and the same thing and the same thing. So we have to enable people to see this world does not have to be this way. At all. It's only this way because this system functions in this way and can only function in this way. This is the nature of this system, and it cannot turn itself into something else, but it has put us in a position where we can get rid of it and turn society into something else. And that's what we have to bring forward to people, and then we have to keep pushing and pushing, because we should be extremely impatient about the way the world is when we put it up against the way it could be and should be. But on the other hand, you have to be serious about this. And you have to do it in a way that actually gives you the best possible chance of winning. Nobody can guarantee you that we can win in any given battle or any given showdown when it comes to the whole thing. But we should put ourselves in the best position to be able to win, to have the best possible chance of winning. And then when the time comes, we should go all out to win. And what we do all the way along from now till then has a great deal to do with even what the chance might come, and a great deal to do with what we'll do with it when it does come.
First of all, I'm glad to meet you in person. I like the way you speak, the way you think, and your ideas. I think that if you would be a president of this nation, you will bring a really big change that we really need. Also, I have one question about the Ten Commandments that you mentioned. What do you think about the commandment that says that we shouldn't wish the wife of our friends or neighbors? Covetous. Thank you.
Well, I thank you for your comments, and I take them in the best spirit. But the problem is, if I were to be the president of the country, it'd be just the way it is now. Or else I'd have to get out. Because you know, we have to change a whole system. If you just try to replace the people in there. I mean, I appreciate what you said, and I thank you. But the fact is that just changing the person who's in will not change the basic conditions. Because this system operates the way it does, and if you get in there, you will either go along with it or be ground up by it and be able to do nothing. And that's happened to many good people, actually, who tried to say, well, you know, I'm going to get in and do something different. But they ended up not being able to, because it isn't just a matter of your intentions. I gave an example talking to some people one time. Let's say that you wanted to have a law that nobody should go hungry. All right, given that people are unemployed, that there's only so much unemployment insurance, that they're cutting back on welfare or whatever, then the logic of having that law would be that if people didn't have food and the grocery stores had lots of food, they should go in and take it. Well, you can't have a law like that in this society, because if people started doing that, it would undermine and destroy the whole economy. This is an economy in which things are produced as commodities for people to pay money for. And if you just start everybody going and taking what they need under this system, it would bring the whole system to a grinding halt. And you could go down the line. What if you said everybody should have health care? Well, you can't provide health care for everybody under this system, because it's not profitable to the big insurance companies and the pharmaceutical companies and so on. They'll tell you that. What if you had a law that there should be no discrimination? Well, you could pass a law. They've had many laws passed, but they don't get rid of discrimination, because discrimination is a necessary part of this system. It's a necessary way to keep people oppressed, to profit off them, and to keep the whole fabric of the society that's built with discrimination and oppression as a crucial part of it. If you tried to get rid of that, you would unravel the whole society. Even on a simple level, you know, I remember when Marlon Brando was on Larry King after this whole thing happened in L.A. here with Alicia Soltero, if you remember that. It was an immigrant woman who was beaten by the police only a couple of years after the Rodney King thing. And Marlon Brando got on Larry King, and Larry King was saying something about, well, what about all these complaints that these immigrants are taking jobs away from Americans? And Marlon Brando said, how many white people do you know want to pick strawberries? And, you know, there's a certain truth to this. These are jobs that, you know, people who are at the bottom of the ladder, are, you know, take in order to try to survive. If all of a sudden you said, let's get rid of all the discrimination and everybody has to compete equally for jobs, you'd rip the whole society apart. Because the discrimination and white supremacy are built into this society. And certain expectations are built up on the basis of that. That doesn't mean people who are suffering under this system who are white don't have an interest in rising up and getting rid of it. But they're going to have to come to terms with that and recognize that they have to throw that off as something that's holding them back from recognizing and fighting for their own interests as part of a class of people that's exploited. So you couldn't do away with that under this system. You could do away with it by abolishing this system where it's no longer profitable and no longer politically to the advantage of the people running the society to have discrimination and segregation and so on. But you couldn't do it inside this society. And you can go down the line from one thing to another to another. So just changing the person, no matter how well they would be inclined to do good, could not change these things. It would, you'd just be kicked out. They'd discover, some scandal that you were involved in. Look, they do this on small levels. I wanted to make a movie. I wanted to encourage somebody to make a movie about like a basketball player who comes up who's a revolutionary. But it's a really good story. And one of the things that would happen is that they would put drugs in his locker. And then they would, discredit him as a drug addict. And that had to be part of this movie, the fight over that. Because this is what happens in the real world. They don't play fair. This is serious business to them, and it has to be to us too. So, this is the nature of the way this system works. And it's got an economic system that functions the way it does, and it has a political structure over it that makes sure that that system functions in the interest of the people who are at the top of it. And it's got a whole machinery of producing ideas and ways of thinking and public opinion that gets people, in line with society continuing to go that way. And so all that has to be overturned and changed, or else we can't bring into being all these things that are straining to come into being. A whole different way of life. Here we are. We live in a world that in many ways, encourages people to cooperate, even in the way people work. And yet it also drives them to compete with each other. And drives them to, like Lenin once said about capitalist society, it forces everybody to calculate with the stinginess of a miser what they're getting compared to what everybody else is getting. Are you getting paid the same amount? And what about your house and everybody else's house? Well, we need to just sweep all that away. And until we do, we'll just, even if you got the best person with the best intentions, they would either be crushed or they just get co-opted. And it's happened over and over again. And then people get demoralized because they say, oh, well, every time we get a leader or anybody who says they're going to do something for us, they sell us out. Well, the reason that happens is because that's the workings of the system. If you try to work within it, you're going to run up against the limitations of what you can do, and then you either quit in despair, or you get crushed, or you get co-opted and start going back on everything you said in order to try to work your way through the system. So this is why we need a revolution.
You didn't answer the...
The commandment. Yeah, sorry. Sorry about that. Look. We don't want a world where people are going around stealing everything from everybody else, okay? Part of the reason that people do that now is because it's for two basic reasons. One, people don't have a lot of the basic things they need. And two, the ideology, the philosophy, the way of thinking of this society encourages people to do that. I mean, what are the people on the street in the ghettos and barrios, what are they in the barrios, what are they doing other than what the people on the Wall Street are doing? Except they don't have the legitimacy of running the system. So they, they're criminals and they have to use criminal means because they can't use the machinery of the government to do what they want to do. But it's the same way of thinking that gets into people's, heads. Because this is pumped at people all the time. That your value is having something that somebody else doesn't have. This is a way you establish yourself as being worth something. You get something somebody else, I don't care how petty it is. And it's amazing what people can get into fighting over. Once this, you know, this whole operation of the system and the way of thinking gets a hold of people, they can fight over any goddamn thing. Anything to show that you are a little bit further ahead than somebody else. So when you put that together with the fact that people are denied a lot of things to begin with and it's, you know, they're struggling to survive anyway, then yes, there's a lot of stuff where people quote unquote covet what other people have, and that's not good. But that's not going to be changed other than, once again, building a whole struggle to change a whole society, to overthrow this system and bring a whole different system with a whole different way of being and of thinking and of relating to other people into being. It's only in the process of doing that that people can change their way of thinking. So the problem with this commandment, as I said, is not the part of it. Look, we can produce. We have a different kind of society. There's the ability to produce plenty of things so that everybody has all the things that they need to live a decent life. And we can also change the thinking of people so they no longer feel that the way they can have any worth in life is if they have something that somebody else doesn't have. So that's the way to deal with that basic problem. The problem with that commandment is, as I said, it's not just, it doesn't just say, don't covet what your neighbor has. That would be relatively harmless. But it goes on to describe those things that are possessions of your neighbors. As I said, including not just, you know, animals they have, or today we'd say, you know, machinery they have or whatever. But also the slaves that they own and the women that they have as possessions. Because this is all talking about men anyway. Whenever it says thou shalt not, it's all talking about what men should and shouldn't do. Because women are an inferior position anyway. And they don't count in the same way. So the woman counts as a possession. The same way a slave counts as a possession. I read this thing in this book about slave trading, where there was a court decision back in one of the southern states before the Civil War, where the judge went on and on about how a horrible thing had been done to this particular person because they'd been unlawfully deprived of their property. And what he was talking about was slaves. And the horror that this judge was waxing eloquent about was how this person had been deprived of their slaves without due process. They'd been taken away by somebody else, another slave owner. This is the view that's reflected in the Bible, that people, slaves and women, are possessions of other people. This is what, if you read it, that's what it says. It doesn't say thou shalt not covet, but then it goes into the possessions of your neighbor that you shouldn't covet. Well, we need a world in which people are not the possessions of other people. We need a world in which people are cooperating to continue to advance, both materially in terms of what we can provide each other to live a better life, and also intellectually and culturally, in terms of the whole way in which we can enter into and find expression in the arts and in the sciences and knowing about the world and bringing forward music and poetry and discussing philosophy. That's the kind of world we need, where people are doing that with each other, not owning and possessing each other and coveting each other's possessions.
I want to know, we say put God aside. In 7 days, he made the whole heaven and earth. And then when it was in the Garden of Eden, he told the day they eat that food, they'd surely die, and that's what happened. And why do you think that there's no God above? In 7 days, he made the heaven and earth.
Well, if I believe that God made the earth, heaven and earth in 7 days, then I would have to, you know, say that we should all worship God. I mean, that sort of follows. If you accept the idea that God made the heavens and the earth, but the question is that really what happened? And if you read, for example, Genesis, the way it describes what happened is not what we know from science actually happened. When different things were, you know, came into being, for example, the planets and stars, did not come into being after the earth and after man, but there have been stars and galaxies and billions of them out there long before the earth or human beings came into existence. So the reason that I don't believe in a God above is because I believe this was a myth that was made up by people to explain what they didn't yet have a scientific basis to really understand. And one of the great things about the age of history that we live in, while even though we're still stuck in this system, we do have, for the first time, the ability to understand a lot of things that people in the past didn't understand. And so they wrote things like the Bible and the Quran and other scriptures, and I believe a lot of them, you know, I don't know, I wasn't there when Muhammad, for example, said that the angel Gabriel came to speak to him. Maybe he actually believed that. I mean, some of the verses of the Quran sound awfully convenient to me. Like when, you know, like when Muhammad's wives are giving him trouble and all of a sudden Allah tells him that if his wives don't calm down, he'll supply better wives for him. That sounded a little bit convenient to me. But I don't know. I don't know whether, you know, I know that the prophets in the Old Testament and Muhammad fasted. You know, they didn't eat or drink much for long periods of time. They were in the desert. Well, you know, you can have you can have lots of things affect you. Your feelings and your thinking. If any of us fast for 3 or 4 days, believe me, you can believe all kinds of things are happening. So, you know, and I don't say that people were insincere. I just say that they didn't understand, you know, the way the world actually is. They reflected what the world around them, you know, seemed to be like. And we live in a period of history when we're learning. That's why my point about the scientists. You know, there were not scientists actually investigating the world until very recently. There were a few people here and there doing it. People in ancient Egypt, people in ancient Greece, you know, different. There were a few people who had a lot of insight actually about things. But they were here and there. And now we have a whole body of, you know, science that's, yes, it's still within a system, but, you know, we have antibiotics, for example. Things that people used to die of all the time are now easily cured because we've come to understand what causes them. Instead of thinking that they're caused by the kind of things the Bible says, we now know that they're caused by, you know, bacteria. Things that you can't see with a naked idea, but which are actual living organisms that are in your body. You have a lot of them all the time, but some of them actually cause effects in your body that are harmful. And then because we've understood that, we now have ways of treating it. And the whole understanding of evolution, by the way, has a tremendous amount to do with developing that cure or those cures. Or another example, take rabies. Now, there's a real scourge. If you get rabies and you don't get treatment quickly enough, you die a horrible death. And before 150 years ago, nobody understood what rabies was. It's a virus that's transmitted by the saliva, through the saliva of whatever it is, like a dog or whatever, that bites you, or a raccoon or whatever. This is a discovery of science. This was not understood until very recently. Because we understand it now, if you get bitten by a rabid dog, you can go get a series of shots and you won't die. But they didn't know that at the time of the Bible. And I'm sure when people got rabies then, they thought they were terribly possessed by the devil because people act all kind of crazy ways and they're miserable. I mean, it's a horrible death. The cells in your body are drying up. You know, most of your body is mainly water and it causes that's why it's called hydrophobia. The cells in your body are drying up. It's a horrible death, but now it can be prevented because people didn't just accept the idea of whatever religious tradition they were brought up in, but they actually investigated the world. And, you know, I know there's this comedian, for example, who died, unfortunately, named Bill Hicks, who has his limitation, but he does have some good stuff on religion. And somebody was telling me one of his routines he does is he says, I got one word for the people who think that God created everything in 7 days. What about dinosaurs? How come dinosaurs are not mentioned in the Bible? Don't you think if there were dinosaurs around, when people were around, they would have noticed them? And yet you never see a mention of dinosaurs in the Bible. Why? Because the people who wrote the Bible didn't know anything about dinosaurs, because dinosaurs were extinct millions of years ago before human beings came around. So, you know, again, look, this is another question of unity, struggle, unity. You know, people are, you know, have grown up believing certain things, and that, you know, they hold fast to those things. And while, you know, I would struggle over those things, at the same time, we have to recognize that we're going to disagree over this. So then what are we going to do to get together to fight over the things we do agree on? I think we both want a different world. We want to bring into being a whole different kind of world. And while we're doing that, we'll see about, you know, struggling out all these questions. But let's hurry up and bring this different world into being. Let's unite over everything we can unite about in doing that. And then let's have an ongoing struggle about how to understand where the world came from, where we came from, what are the real forces driving this forward, what are the real things in nature and society that we have to understand in order to more fully change things. But let's unite while we're doing that. So, I'm told that has to be it, so I'm sorry, but, you know, maybe there'll be some other way we can have another discussion where we get into things more fully. And I thank everyone that came. It was, you know, a great pleasure for me to be able to spend this time with you. Thank you very much.